this is a quote from you, Ralph. Everyone who has surgery wants it, but we still don't know how the drugs make us unconscious and eliminate the perception of pain. And I guess it seemed odd to me that we've been using this practice for so long and really don't know how it works. Does that happen a lot in medicine?
Yes. Much of medicine is heroic because physicians don't always have the adequate tools. So as a result, they're often treating symptoms rather than curing diseases. In the case of anesthesiology, the drugs, the language we use is to say they were empirically derived, meaning we learned to use them very safely through experience. And this is a common phenomenon in medicine.
And that's particularly true for drugs that affect the central nervous system and behavior. For example, we know the mechanisms by which antibiotics work to treat and cure disease. But diseases of the central nervous system, such as psychiatric disorders or altering states of consciousness, since we don't know really the mechanisms by which those states are generated, then it's harder to know how the drugs work to alter them.
In neuroscience, does the individuality of the patient have more to do with the medicine than, in epidemiology?
There's an entire discipline, pharmacogenetics, and that's what you're talking about. And indeed, many of us have had the experience of going to a physician, being prescribed a drug, obviously not an antibiotic, but sometimes even an antibiotic, and the physician will say, if this doesn't help you within 2 or 3 days, we have another one that we can try. So certainly different drugs work better for different people.
Sleeping medications are a good example of that, as are antidepressants, SSRIs and SNRIs. Sometimes people have to try several different ones before they find the one that works for them. So it's partly due to pharmacogenetics. In other words, how people individually respond to drugs.
So coming back to your STEM question, that's part of it. Part of it's genetic. And I think earlier it speaks to what Helen said about the complexity of the disorder. People often underestimate just how complex these central nervous system-based disorders are.
What do we know about states of consciousness then?
First, we have to define states of consciousness to answer that question. So for this purpose, I will talk about states of sleep, wakefulness, and then anesthetically induced states. There's all sorts of states of consciousness. The neurobiology of sleep and wakefulness is probably the best understood. We know a lot about the neural pathways and the neurotransmitters that regulate states of sleep and wakefulness, and we know how those neurons and neural centers interact with each other. We know what the projections are and so forth. We understand that pretty well.
In the vernacular, people talk about altered states of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And, of course, those include neuropsychiatric disorders. They include drug-induced states. I agree with Helen. Sleep is probably the best understood. Sleep and wakefulness, the neurobiology, are probably the best understood of all states. The neuropsychiatric disorders are very complex and remain poorly understood. We're making progress. But another state is pain. Pain is an altered state. Mm-hmm. And that's hugely important in terms of another area in which we hope that this research will advance patient care.
One of the reasons why we understand sleep and wakefulness at the neurobiological level is because all mammals sleep, and all mammals have pretty similar
sleep patterns,
thank you, mm-hmm. to humans. I mean, there are differences, but they're basically fundamentally similar, and therefore we've been able to study those basic mechanisms using animal models. So the diseases for which we have the most understanding are diseases for which we have good animal models. Psychiatric disorders are more difficult because it's hard to model symptoms of psychiatric disorders. That's one reason they're more difficult to get an understanding.
I'm assuming that if we share these sleep patterns with other animals, then they're very similar among humans, and there's not a lot of differentiation in how those patterns occur or what they are. Is that correct?
That is correct. For example, all of them have a circadian basis, a 24-hour rhythm. Within a sleep period, they all have episodes of non-REM sleep, non-rapid eye movement sleep, and rapid eye movement sleep, the rapid eye movement phase we all know to be the dreaming phase of sleep. All animal studies so far have some of the same autonomic depressions. Breathing is slowed. All of us, when we sleep, we become snake-like. We stop temperature regulating. All mammals, humans included, when we sleep, our motor neurons are actively inhibited, which means we don't act out our dreams normally unless we have a brain lesion, and there is a whole disorder referred to as REM behavior disorder. Helen's point is true. For every disease beyond states of consciousness in which we've made progress, it's because we've had good animal models.
Okay, well, let's go back to anesthesia then for a minute. When you put a patient to sleep, where do they go?
The first thing is that anesthesia is not the same as sleep. And in the case that you used the word sleep, which is the way many anesthesiologists use it also, it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor because it's something familiar and comforting and safe. Sleep is generally thought of as a good thing. So it's not scary when your anesthesiologist says, we're going to put you to sleep, even though the states are very, very different. So I just wanted to make that point.
Okay.
Where do we go? That's a more difficult question. Mm-hmm.
The clear answer would be we don't know. In other words, what happens to consciousness? If a person is fortunate to reach their 50th birthday, under current medical guidelines, one of the first things your primary care physician will tell you to do is to have endoscopy. People who have endoscopy have a greater chance of detection and therefore rectifying any sort of cancer. And it's a remarkable experience for most people who have never done drugs. 1 minute, you're on the table ready to begin the procedure. And very common, and anybody working in the medical procedure unit will be nodding their heads at this point. And the next minute, they're saying, when do we start? And they'll say, get out of here. We did this 20 minutes ago. So we don't know. What happens? Where is that gap? It's a gap in our consciousness that is gone, as near as we can tell. That's an unanswered question. And that's a great question, because that illustrates how these clinical cases can inform us about consciousness. And again, that's one of the great opportunities that the discipline of anesthesiology has. They're studying the animal of interest, that is, human beings. And every anesthetic induction is an opportunity to study a state of consciousness. So the induction, the maintenance, and the emergence of anesthesia is a great opportunity for studying consciousness. And that's one of the other reasons we're so thrilled to be able to link psychology and anesthesiology.
How do you study this when you put somebody under? They don't dream, do they?
It depends on the anesthetic. Many people will have hallucinoid activity during anesthetic states. What is the qualitative difference between mentation during anesthesia and mentation during naturally occurring rapid eye movement sleep? It would probably depend on things like age of the patient, sex of the patient, the drug that was administered, and whether it was there for a diagnostic procedure versus a serious surgery, and so on and so on.
And when the anesthesiologists do their job correctly, and they almost always do, the patient remembers nothing. Mm-hmm. So even if they had mentation, the drugs are administered to prevent them from having recall.
This is very important with regard to the potential for post-traumatic stress disorder. So Helen's point is that one of the main features of good anesthetic, there are five features. One of the main features is amnesia. Because it's a state that's an oscillating state, anesthetic-induced state. People will move to various levels of arousal. The metaphor that's often used for anesthesia is aviation. Like a takeoff, there's an induction phase. Like to get to your destination is the maintenance phase. And like a landing phase is the emergence phase. And the other part of the metaphor is that during an anesthetic case, anesthesiologists are trained very well to, we would say, fly at the level of the treetops. You want the patient deep, but not too deep. Too deep is very dangerous because, remember, these drugs are poisons. The relationship between the safety or the efficacious level, the effective level, and the lethal level is very close. And anesthesiologists have learned to regulate that very effectively.
In your research, then, what are the questions that you're trying to answer?
A common thing is localization of function. This was something that developed in 19th century neurology. We say the brain is not a bowl of soup, okay? It is regional, and the functions are regional. So the early neurologists and the French and Italian neurologists recognized that if a person had a damage to one side of the brain, there would be disorders on the other side of the body. And so people began to realize function was localized. And so one of the questions for anesthesia is which of these areas in the brain are most important for causing these changes in states of consciousness. Now, by extension, you know, what we like to do in science is to get smaller and smaller, reduce things down, because then we can interact. So not only where in the brain, but what neurotransmitters in the brain, what cells, how these cells talk to one another. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's the genetic component. Different people respond differently to anesthetics. So those, we talk about this as vertical integration. We'd like to understand this at the vertically integrated level, because then by understanding, just like antibiotics, mm-hmm. if you understand how a chemical alters a bacteria and keeps it from thriving in our bodies, then you can change the broader state. And likewise, if we understand how these anesthetics alter cells and brain regions, then we can understand how to design better anesthetics. Anyone who's had anesthesia, they benefit from the elimination of pain, but it won't make you smarter temporarily for a few days. You'll be very impaired cognitively. Mm. Nausea and vomiting after anesthesia is very common. We shouldn't just accept that as something to be eliminated. And people can give other drugs, what they call balanced anesthesia, to eliminate that. But what we'd like to have is a drug that has all the desired effects. Rapid onset, rapid offset, so you don't feel foggy the next day. Safe, doesn't depress breathing, cardiovascular system, temperature. Doesn't impair our immune function, mm-hmm. doesn't impair our cognition. That's a huge problem for those of us who have had our older loved ones undergo even a minor procedure.